Writers Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to A.J. Hartley. He's the author of a number of books. The ones we're going to talk about are two new books that are forthcoming. One is called Steeplejack, which is coming from Tor in June of 2016. And the other one is called Secret Machines, being published by To the Stars Media in April 2016. So we're going to talk about books that I've read, but that no one else has read publicly. So we will be very careful not to give away too much. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, this is really fun. So we're doing this live in a kind of echoey room, which I hope is okay, in Southern California, which is not where either of us are from. You live in North Carolina.
That's right, in Charlotte.
And teach at UNC.
UNC Charlotte, yes.
And obviously anyone who is hearing this realizes you're from England.
I am. Originally from Lancashire in the Northwest, but I've lived in the States for 28 years, I think, now.
That's more than half your life.
Yeah, tragically.
So it's really, I think one of the things that might be interesting to people is this kind of tension between, I don't mean tension in a negative form, but the kind of interplay between being a serious scholar of Shakespearean literature and writing contemporary fiction for all ages. You've written children's books, you've written YA, you've written adult books.
Yes.
So how does it fit in your, for you? I mean, it's something that I think most people would find unusual.
It is unusual. It's not unheard of, but it's only unusual for me in the sense of navigating two different realms as a sort of professional presence. I don't find it particularly different in terms of the actual work itself. Part of what always drew me to Shakespeare was the sense that he was a popular writer and that he's a genre writer.
I think that people today probably forget that.
Yeah, I think
many
so.
Many readers are afraid of Shakespeare because it seems to be the canon of literature.
Right, that he's been absorbed into that whole notion of literary fiction or literary. I mean, obviously he's a playwright primarily. But a storyteller, and a storyteller who works in the areas of the sensational, you know. Big stories that are genre specific, that for the various genres of his period, you know, comedy, tragedy, history, romance, and sort of subdivided within, you know, those categories, romantic comedy, satirical comedy, whatever. Those are plays that play according to the rules of their genre, and part of what I find appealing about Shakespeare is that he's able to work within those genres and often complicate them and refine them and tweak them in interesting ways, delivering what the audience expects of the genre while still producing work which is rich and complex in terms of character or theme or idea or sort of sentence level utterance.
Right. Brilliant writing.
Of course, right. That is. And that's not something that we associate with genre writing today, unfortunately.
Well, when you write, do you strive to I think your writing is extremely good. It's better than many. It's hard to measure these things. You know, who's a really good writer, who's a good writer, but I think your writing is extraordinarily good. So that's something that I think, you know, plainly matters to you.
Yes, yeah. I like words. I like sentence level writing. I sometimes meet genre writers who, it seems, don't particularly. Maybe that's not entirely fair, but sometimes that there's so much emphasis on the story that we forget that the story as an experience is constructed in that sort of moment-to-moment writing. It's not all just about plot.
I'm almost Buddhist.
Yes. and this is not to say, of course, that there aren't a lot of really great genre writers out there. There are.
So do you feel that, I assume you've read every Shakespearean play?
Yes, some of them I haven't. You get into the habit of the plays that you teach most frequently, the plays that you work on theatrically, or the ones that you see theatrically. And one of the things that's really striking when you look at a canon of, depending on how you count, 38, 40 plays, most, even professional Shakespeare companies, are frequently only doing about 8 to 10 of them on a regular basis. So yes, I have. Yeah, of course, I've read them all. I don't teach them all. I don't write about all of them, you know.
Do you feel that there are particular ones that have resonated in your writing more than others, or influenced you in some literal way?
I think, you know, there are obvious ones, like Hamlet, which I find myself constantly...
In which you wrote a novel.
That's true, yes.
Version of, which, yeah. By the way, I really think is a great piece of work.
Oh, thank you. And that was co-written with David Hewson, and it was written primarily for audio. There is a print, a text version as well, but it was written first for audio. But yeah, I seem to keep sort of colliding with Hamlet over the years, either working on it in performance or writing about it as a scholar, or the novel that you mentioned. And I think, you know, it's a sort of quintessential example of exactly what I'm talking about. It's a story with ghosts and murders and pirates. Pirates are only in the second quarto, and so they're not in the first quarto. But they're there. You know, these sort of larger-than-life story elements. It's a revenge tragedy, you know. But nobody would dispute the idea that this is also one of the seminal pieces of literature in the Western canon.
So do you think, I mean, can we draw a connection between Hamlet and your science fiction writing, do you think, in that way? That in other words, this is not really the way I would put it, but if we could imagine Shakespeare writing today, and that's not to say that you are trying to be Shakespeare, but if he was writing today, the language of science fiction, the terms and the kind of possibilities of science fiction might appeal to him in the same way that it appeals to you.
Yeah, I think so. And certainly, you know, Shakespeare has his sort of fantasist side. Science fiction is not a spectrum which is open to him, but fantasy is. You know, if you look at plays like Tempest or Winter's Tale, Midsummer Night's Dream, they're full of magic and supernatural, and stories that some of them, at least particularly in Midsummer Night's Dream, elements of folklore that he probably grew up with. And I think, you know, the great test of those kinds of plays is whether he can incorporate those elements and still produce something serious, something profound. And I think there's no... I mean, and people don't always see that. I mean, Pepys, I think, famously said that Midsummer Night's Dream was the silliest stuff he'd ever seen on stage. But, you know, I think you don't have to spend too much time looking closely at that play to see that there's a lot of very serious stuff in play.
Well, Lewis Carroll is, you know, you could say, well, Lewis Carroll is just playing with words, and then... But, you know, clearly there's more going on. But I just thought of something that interesting. I'm sure this is not new in the world, but I hadn't thought of it before just now, thinking about Shakespeare and the, you know, the fantasy and imagination that he was working with often was from he was looking into the past. Whereas science fiction we think of as more speculative, looking into the future. And I wonder if in 16th and 17th century England, there was a significantly different cultural outlook where we are fascinated with the future. We think about the future all the time. Mm-hmm. They were driven by what had happened in the past.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think some of that is the consequence of industrialization in the 19th century. in which the kind of progress, in inverted commas, that we made was so extraordinarily quick that it begs the question of what comes next.
Right. We've changed our concept of time through industrialization, whereas, and it's probably obviously true that in that era in England and Europe, particularly, although their world was changing, the pace of change was extremely slow, so that you could live an entire lifetime without significant difference in the technology that would surround you.
Right. Yeah,
I think that's true. Different today.
Right.
Exactly. That's an that's an interesting cultural difference, but it also obviously culture and literature are connected. Storytelling may be universal, but the tools and techniques reflect the time.
Yeah, I got into a conversation not too long ago with a Shakespeare professor, Tiffany Stern, at Oxford University, and we were talking about beer bottles and the consumption of beer in the Globe Theatre. And we were trying to sort of figure out how these things would have been produced and how they would have been capped. And this is, this because I was at the time...
Corks?
Well, this is the thing, that they would have... cork with a wiring system, because I had stumbled on this idea because when I'd been writing another novel called What Time Devours, there was one of the things that came up was I was writing about the French champagne industry and the fact that a lot of the that when champagne was produced, it was flat, it was not gassy, and it was when champagne was brought to England, that something to do with the sort of recarbonation, that it would become very effervescent and it would burst the bottles or pop the corks. And it was the British who used the sort of cork wiring system, because that's how they produced. But the point of all this is to say there was no automated system for capping bottles because, why am I talking about this? But because they couldn't reproduce anything with that degree of accuracy because there was no automated system.
Everything
was being done by hand.
Right.
So therefore, everything was irregular.
Which includes, actually, there is something we can talk about. The printing of Shakespearean plays varies from version to version for precisely that reason.
Yeah.
You don't have each printer... would have to reset the type by hand, one letter at a time, introducing the possibility for misinterpretation, error, changes in spacing. Writers for hundreds of years, writers would read proofs and go crazy because the typesetter was changing their words.
And we see evidence of texts being copy edited on the fly in the printing process, so that even within a single print run, the document will
different, right? Because as you see it on the press, the sheet comes off. You're not going to go back and reprint when it's so painstaking to print a single page.
Yeah,
that's a really well. Let's talk a little bit about your books, which are manufactured by high speed printing presses, not by hand. But the book Secret Machines is a. It's a book we've actually talked about as being difficult to categorize. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that problem, how the book is, it's the first in a trilogy, which is also an issue that, have to wrestle with when you're writing book one of a projected trilogy.
Yeah, it's a book about secret space programs and... government conspiracies of one kind or another, and in many ways when you talk about it, it sounds like a conventional thriller, but it also crosses over, for depending on your position on these things, into science fiction perhaps, but it also has a sort of historical fiction component because the book spans periods as well as
it has multiple characters, which each of whom has his own complete story arc.
Right, exactly. So there are four major point of view characters, and part of the architecture of the book is to give them all a separate thread they each get their own chapter and then it cycles back, and to gradually draw them all together so that it's increasingly clear that we're looking at four aspects of the same story, and in the course of the book, those different plot lines and timelines interweave to provide, hopefully, a unified, coherent.
Well, this book is a collaboration with Tom DeLonge,
mm-hmm.
And you mentioned collaborating with David Hewson on the Hamlet book, so mm-hmm. you're not unfamiliar with collaboration, but many writers are individuals who don't write with others, so maybe you could talk a little bit about how you and Tom worked out the construct of this book.
Yeah, and this is a very different collaborative process from when I was working with David. I did those two books, The Macbeth and Hamlet, and we basically wrote 50% each, and we would divide up the story, identify the parts that we were most interested in, and we would send each other pages, and we would edit each other, but...
So not necessarily working linearly?
Not exactly. I mean, sometimes. I think it was sort of de facto linear most of the time. And I was in the US and he was in the UK. And so because of the time difference, it meant that I would wake up and there'd be 10 pages from David, which was infuriating because now I ain't going to write my 10. So it was actually it was a great experience because we wrote very fast. I think because we were constantly spurring each other on by producing. And then the trick there was to sort of synthesize the voice. And it took, with both books, I think it took us a little while to smooth things out initially until we got into the feel of how we were writing. With Tom, it was a completely different process because he was never interested in doing the sort of sentence level writing that he came to me with, you know, some big ideas and a lot of research and a lot of information. And the challenge was to try and figure out how to tell the kind of story that he wanted to tell. And we had a lot of conversations on the phone. And then the first time we actually sat down together in person and just sort of brainstormed and covered the desk in sheets of paper and scribbled on things. And we emerged with that multiple character structure that I was just talking about. Part of which came out of the fact that we were ranging over events of about 70 years.
All in the 20th crossing into the 21st century.
Exactly, yeah. And looking to try and keep that sense of unity and figuring out how those different stories would evolve and intersect. And then basically he would then continue to send me... because he was doing a lot of hard research, he's doing a lot of interviews of people in the military and in the Secret Service and in the aerospace industry and so on. And he would be sending me what he was finding, what he was learning in the process. And I would then find a way to try and incorporate that stuff. And I would send him what I had. And he would say, this is great, or can we tweak this? You know, can we think about this? But it's a very different kind of... And one of the great things about working with him is that he actually took a very hands-off approach to the actual construction of the story and the telling of it.
So, for Tom, this is a very passionate, passion-driven project.
Absolutely.
Did you come to this having the kind of background and understanding about secret government programs and UFO kinds of things, or was this something that was all new to you that you've... Also, I mean, clearly you've become passionate about it as well, in the sense that the writing is incredibly vivid and, you know, this is real.
Mm-hmm.
And it is fiction, but there's a lot of reality in this story.
Right, yeah. No, it wasn't something I knew much or anything about. I mean, I had been interested in stuff like this when I was a kid, but no, it wasn't a subject that I knew anything about, really. And that was quite paralyzing at first, because the sheer wealth, I don't know that wealth is the word, the sheer volume of information out there on this stuff, especially on UFOs and things, was both vast and complicated in terms of the extent to which you could take it seriously. you know, and faced with the scale of it, I found that quite daunting, and starting to sort of try to sift through what I was finding or what Tom was sending me, and try to sort of scrutinize it, evaluate how much weight to give to certain kinds of elements of the story was difficult. But even, you know, even the real stuff, even the obviously non-controversial stuff, like, you know, one of the characters is a Harrier fighter pilot. Okay, so write that. Now, you know, I'm not a fighter pilot. So, and I that first scene that we were talking about earlier, that took me ages to write, and it was a sort of blank screen for so long on my computer, because every time I tried to sort of say, I know what has to happen in this, but I don't know how a pilot experiences this, flying a high-tech aircraft over Afghanistan at night. And I spent a lot of time talking to pilots and studying the, you know, the layout of the cockpit and all the rest of it, trying to sort of figure out how to plausibly present this, not simply because I wanted to get it right, though I did, but I also wanted the reader to feel like, to feel the reality that the character feels, that the character takes for granted, you know, that to get into the head of the character, I needed to understand what it's like to be traveling at high speeds, right, in a plane like that.
Well, because isn't that, it's sort of one of the key challenges of fiction, is you're telling, I know it sounds trite, but you're telling the truth in fiction, and it has to be plausible, even though it's
not right,
true, right, literally. But I think nobody can have every experience. It's not possible. So you can't, if you are, I mean, maybe that's the test of a writer, is to be able to, that's where the imagination can carry you, mm-hmm, and enable you to write about something that you've not experienced. And I'll go back to Shakespeare. Did he ever end up, did he go to France? I don't know whether he actually ever left England. He wrote about people in France. He wrote about Romeo and Juliet in Italy. I don't think he ever went to Italy.
Right.
So that's, imagine, you know, that's where, and it relates a little bit to this, I think, to the other book that we want to talk about at least a little bit, which is Steeplejack. Mm-hmm. Which is written in the voice and spirit of a young girl of color that is very far from you as a person.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think you're right. I think, you know, that writing is always an exercise in research and empathy. And it's the marriage of those two that hopefully allows you to get away with representing people who are not you. And I understand the sort of the write what you know kind of mantra. But that only gets you so far in genre fiction, right? So, but that's the challenge. And especially with Steeplejack, you know, writing a character without recourse to stereotypes, without recourse to foregrounding ethnicity in a way that an individual might not be consciously doing all the time, you know, I think that was part of the challenge for that book. You know, hopefully people will think that it has been done with sensitivity and thoughtfulness, but it's difficult and it's a bit scary. But I've always wanted to write characters who were not like me, and I have always wanted to write characters who experience a kind of otherness, because I think that's something I do have personal experience of, or always have had. No matter where I've lived in a lot of places, and I've never quite fit in exactly, you know? That's something that I like to access in my fiction. So, you know, actually looking back over the books that I've written, you know, the protagonist of my first novels was a very tall Jewish woman who's a museum curator.
that certainly is not you.
That is also not me. The protagonist of the Darwin Arkwright middle grade series was a mixed race boy living in Atlanta, an English boy living in Atlanta.
Which you have actually lived in.
Well, that's the thing. So, you know, there are bits of me in there, but there are also bits of me that are not, you know. That was very deliberate. And when I'm writing somebody who's clearly has a very different set of experiences from me, I want to still be able to connect with that person so that I can feel their individuality and their complexity and to think as they hopefully would think.
But when you're writing science fiction, which you do, you're not only putting yourself into another character, you're putting yourself into another world,
right,
which you have to imagine.
Yeah.
And then I'm always wondering about that. How do you maintain an awareness of the consistency of an experience that has never existed?
Right.
You know, it's sort of like making up a new language.
Yeah.
And you'd have to think about, you have to understand how language works, but then you also have to think about all these terms and descriptions for experiences that actually have never existed in our lives. So that seems such a challenge, you know, for anybody writing science fiction.
Yeah, I think it is, though I also think that you're also constantly thinking that the people reading this are people who live in your own cultural moment. So you can never completely lose track of that. And that's obvious, but you know, I think sometimes when science fiction and fantasy doesn't work for me, sometimes it's because the world building is too complete. Mm-hmm. And the sense of being immersed in something utterly alien might be brilliantly thought through, but there's a point at which I start to disengage as a reader because it's representing something so foreign.
Because it's so completely imagined, it removes the ability of you as the reader to imagine for yourself.
That's also true, yeah. And I think in fantasy and science fiction, good science fiction and fantasy are always still telling contemporary, realist, urgent stories. The issues that the characters are going through should have a kind of analogous connection to things that are happening in the world. That's how I approach it. So if the world of the story becomes too distant from the world of the reader, then you lose that, in a sense, you lose the capacity to make those kind of analogous connections. Maybe. At least that's something that I'm alert to.
Well, you mentioned the word empathy, and that maybe you need, it's not the, there's the writer's empathy, but then there's also the reader's empathy.
Exactly, yeah.
It's sort of interesting to think about that, you know, some books that don't survive the test of time, as they say, maybe partially because they are too much of the moment.
Yeah.
And they lose their universality as time goes on. You know, if you look at the bestseller list from 1917 or 18, there only are a couple of books on that list that are still read today. Mm-hmm. Most of them were very popular because they were so of their time.
Sure. Yeah.
And
yeah.
So that may be, you know, that's always this kind of balance for the writer.
Mm-hmm.
We mentioned that your Darwin Arkwright series. How many books are in that?
Three.
And I think you recently won an award for... the book was named on a
Oh, that's right. It was on a Barnes & Noble top 10 adventure books for boys.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah.
So do you read a lot of, that's for a much younger age. That's for 8, 9, 10-year-olds.
Yeah.
And Steeplejack, which is really considered young adult, maybe, you know, 15 to 20-year-olds.
Sure. Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, the protagonist is 17.
Yeah, I think I've read it and I really liked it, so I don't think... You know, it's not too young for most adult readers. But so, and then Secret Machines, of course, is a grown-up book.
Yeah.
So you write for almost all Asia's at different times. Mm-hmm. Is there, do you have a feeling about what you prefer if you had to choose? Or do you not want to choose precisely?
Yeah, I don't want to choose. I don't want to choose the age group of my readership or the characters, and I don't want to choose the genre, you know? Part of why I love writing so much is because I feel like I have the freedom to say, oh, here's a neat idea for a story, and then not follow it up with, oh yeah, but it doesn't suit my market, it doesn't suit my readership. It's like, no, if it's a story that I want to write, then I can write it. And one of the advantages of having what I laughingly call a day job is that I'm not absolutely dependent on the sales of my next book to pay my mortgage, which gives me a certain amount of freedom to say, I'm going to write a sci-fi novel, I'm going to write a detective story, I'm going to, you know. Now, I wouldn't offer that as advice, as a career model for anybody to follow. I'm sure my agent frequently wishes I would just write one bloody book and stick to it, because it'd be a lot easier to market. But no.
Well, in that way, you have the freedom to be artistic, you know, to be an artist and to write what you want to write.
Right.
Which is a nice thing.
Yeah.
So, as a reader, are there particular writers, aside from Shakespeare, writing today, let's say a current contemporary writers, or are there a couple that you could name as writers whose work you really look at as being, I'm not going to try to say, you know, on the same level as a Shakespeare, but right, that you feel are really extraordinary, that the people that you cleave to as the greats of our era?
As my interest in genre shifts and my own output changes, so my reading changes quite a bit from time to time. But I, for the last couple of years, I've been a great devotee of Terry Pratchett, the late great Terry Pratchett, because I think that he's somebody who demonstrates that you can write funny, serious books, you know, and he can work within genre while still doing social satire and particularly a fan of his Commander Rhymes books and that are all set in the same city in Ingmarsbrook. And the sense of the depth of that city, the complexity of it, the way it has evolved over the years, that it feels like a real place. That's something that I thought a lot about when I was writing Steeplejack. But also just that sense of telling an exciting story. In the case of the Vimes books, they are detective stories in a fantasy world that has a comic element, but are also doing the sort of quite overtly political and social commentary. So you've got a bunch of different genres all jammed together, and it's the absolute antidote to all that bad 70s and 80s fantasy where if it didn't have a dwarf and a troll in it, it wasn't really fantasy. You know what I mean? That sense of the sort of knockoff Tolkien approach to fantasy writing. I'll name no names. But Pratchett sort of reclaims that and says, you know, yes, we're in, there are dwarves and trolls, though they're not the way that you expect them to be at all. And they're part of this city where we're telling sort of noir detective stories, and it's great. I love that stuff.
Oh, that's great. Well, sort of, yeah. That's I think that's a good description of his work. aside from the fact that he's also a really good writer.
Right.
Which means, you know, that's a huge part.
Yeah, I get very irritated. There was a piece in, I forget which newspaper it was, it might have been The Guardian. Somebody was going after Pratchett as not a very good writer a year or so ago, and I got very irritated with that kind of criticism, the assumption that that quality literature is about wallowing in sentence level pyrotechnics and sorry, that's a mixed metaphor, but and telling stories in which nothing happens and it all goes badly. that's not my model for books.
Well, I like the books that you've written so far.
Thank you.
You really are a good writer as well. So thank you for spending a little time talking to me.
Thank you.
This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to A.J. Hartley. We've been talking about Secret Machines and Steeplejack.